I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary pledges military support to Israel. The U.N. Arab League envoy for Syria urges U.N. action in the nation. A call for an end to Lebanon-Syrian cross-border attacks.
There has been sort of an escalation of these cross-border attacks, which in many ways signifies sort of a regional, further regionalization of the crisis in Syria.
And Kenyans are lining up for Middle East jobs. It's all ahead. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has assured Israel that the U.S. government is committed to preserving Israel's military strength in the Middle East. The remark follows a meeting with the Israeli defense minister today on the second day of a week-long trip to the region. VOA's Scott Bobb has details from Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel underscored the Obama administration's support for Israel's security at a news conference following his meeting with Israeli defense minister Moshe Yaalon.
We're committed to providing Israel with whatever support is necessary for Israel to maintain military superiority over any state or coalition of states and non-state actors. Given the range of complex security challenges facing the United States and Israel in this region,
Israel is Hagel's first stop of a six-day trip to the Middle East that is expected to be dominated by concerns over Iran's controversial nuclear program, Syria's civil war, and political fallout in the region from the Arab Spring. Hagel said the U.S. government would allow Israel to buy advanced U.S. missiles designed to take out air defenses, radar for fighter jets, aerial refueling planes, and tilt-rotor transport aircraft that can take off and land vertically. This is part of a $10 billion weapons sales program announced Saturday that will also include advanced missiles for Saudi Arabia and F-16 fighter jets for the United Arab Emirates. Hagel is to visit those two countries as well as Jordan and Egypt. Hagel told reporters on his plane Sunday that the weapons sale to Israel was a clear signal to Iran that both the United States and Israel were prepared for military action to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Iran says its nuclear program has peaceful aims, but the West suspects otherwise. Hagel said the U.S. would let Israel decide whether it needed to attack Iran.
Israel is a sovereign nation. Every sovereign nation has a right to defend itself. That calculation has to be made by the sovereign nation.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whom Hagel is to meet Tuesday, says Iran is close to achieving nuclear weapon capability. U.S. officials say they believe there is still time for diplomacy and economic sanctions to work. Hagel is also viewing Israeli defenses in the occupied Golan Heights. Syrian rebels now control parts of territory on the Syria-held side. Israeli forces have fired on them several times after missiles landed in Israeli-controlled areas. Officials said security along Israel's border with Egypt's Sinai Desert is also on the agenda, one week after two rockets landed harmlessly in the Israeli Red Sea port of Eilat. Mr. Netanyahu blamed the attack on Palestinian militants from Gaza who had infiltrated the region, and he pledged to respond. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The United Nations Arab League envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, says he thinks about quitting every day, but has no plans to do so. He says that the Syrians need to come up with a plan to end the more than two-year crisis and urge the UN Security Council to take action. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
The 79-year-old veteran diplomat briefed the Security Council Friday in a closed meeting on his efforts to find a political solution, amid rumors that he was planning to step down. Speaking to reporters afterwards, he said there is no basis to the reports.
I haven't resigned. Every day I wake up, I think I should resign. But I haven't so far.
He also dismissed media reports that he said he had agreed to stay on for an additional 3 months. The rumors of his impending resignation emerged recently after diplomats said he felt the Arab League's decision to give Syria's seat to the opposition undermined his role as a mediator. Brahimi said he has had extensive discussions with both the Syrian government and the opposition, as well as with international players, the United States and Russia, on finding a way out of the conflict.
With the Syrians, I got nowhere. With the Security Council, the Americans and the Russians, we made some progress, but it was far too little.
He said it is up to the Syrians to come up with their own plan to end the fighting, but also urged the Security Council to use their leverage.
And if they really believe that they are in charge of looking after peace and security, There is no time for them to lose to really take this question more seriously than they have until now.
The 15-nation council has been divided over the Syrian crisis, with Western powers supporting the opposition and Russia backing the government, leaving the UN's most powerful organ in a deadlock and unable to contain the crisis. The United Nations estimates that the conflict in Syria has killed more than 70,000 people. UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos said Thursday that nearly 7 million people are in need inside the country, and there are more than 1 million refugees in the region. She warned that the security situation has left the organization dangerously close to suspending some critical aid operations. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The United Nations head of humanitarian operations is warning that it could take decades to rebuild Syria's decimated infrastructure. Zhang Ying recently returned from Syria, where he said he found appalling suffering and phenomenal devastation. He said among the worst-hit cities are Aleppo in the north, a former commercial hub of the country that is now in parts a ghost town, and Daraa in the far south, where the crisis began more than 2 years ago when a group of teenagers scrawled anti-government graffiti on their school. In Aleppo, Ying said the city is divided between government and opposition-controlled areas. In regimen areas, he said, there is only an hour or two of electricity daily, and there is significant damage to infrastructure, but shops are open and reasonably well supplied. He said this is in stark contrast to the situation in opposition-controlled areas of the city. He said, quote, "We were shocked by what we saw immediately. The streets are strewn with rubbish. It's a public health disaster in the making. They have no electricity at all. The phone network, both landline and mobile, totally cut off. Very little traffic moving around because there's almost no fuel. Also, we were told that people had water once every 5 days. The shops are almost empty, depleted." End quote. Lebanese state media says several shots fired from the Syrian side of the border landed near the northern Lebanese town of Hermel on Sunday. Syrian rebels said the shelling was in retaliation for Hezbollah intervening in the Syrian civil war on the side of the Assad government. The main Syrian opposition coalition released a statement demanding that Hezbollah withdraw fighters from Syria immediately and urging the Lebanese government to stop the militant group from intervening further. Hezbollah is a key ally of Syrian President Assad, but has denied sending its fighters to Syria to help him battle a 2-year rebellion. Human Rights Watch, in a report today, is calling on all parties in the Syrian conflict to stop indiscriminate cross-border attacks. We spoke about the appeal with Lama Faki, the Syrian-Lebanon researcher at HRW.
There has been sort of an escalation of these cross-border attacks, which in many ways signifies sort of a further regionalization of the crisis in Syria. Earlier this week, I was in the Bekaa in northeast Lebanon and documented some of these cross-border shells that tragically killed two civilians in villages in Lebanon.
And you say both sides are doing this?
So these attacks were by the opposition groups, Syrian opposition groups, but we have previously documented cross-border attacks by the Syrian government in other areas in Lebanon, including in Arsal and Wadi Khalid.
Why are they doing this?
When the government has done it, they've said in some cases that they are firing at armed opposition fighters that are seeking refuge in Lebanon, that are trying to sort of flee into Lebanon so that they can't get to them. And with the opposition, the most recent opposition attacks, they have said that Hezbollah has been striking them from this position in the north, and so they are essentially fighting back in this way. The reality is, though, that these continue to be sort of attacks that are affecting the civilian population. These are not sort of attacks that are that have clear military targets.
It would be very worrisome if we see this very violent confrontation in Syria spill over the borders.
Of course, and that's why we're calling on the Lebanese government to do more to sort of secure the area, but also on both the Syrian government and armed opposition groups to abide by their IHL obligations, their international humanitarian law obligations, and not conduct these indiscriminate strikes, which do just serve to harm civilians.
Would you mind specifically saying which international humanitarian laws are at issue here?
Sure. For a lawful attack to take place, there would need to be a legitimate military target. And in this case, what we've seen is that the opposition, with the most recent strikes, has been using 107-millimeter rockets, which are unguided rockets. And they're using them as well with sort of homemade rocket launchers, which makes them even more inaccurate. So when these types of weapons are used in populated areas without clear military targets, and they fall in residential areas, you know, this is sort of a random strike. It's an indiscriminate strike without military target, and it is therefore illegal. Similarly, I mean, with the Syrian government's attacks, we've seen the type of weaponry that they've used and the way that they have used it has really lent itself to harming the civilian population, again, because they're not targeted weapons, and they're not taking due precautions to ensure that they're not erroneously hitting civilian targets.
Lama Faki, the Syrian-Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking with us from Urfa, Turkey. Young Kenyans facing a tough job market at home are traveling abroad for work at hotels and homes in the Middle East. While recruiters promise steady work at a good wage, the reality can be much different. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Josselow has this report from Nairobi.
No, 20-year-old Bernard Akech has too much time on his hands. Since graduating from high school 2 years ago, he has yet to find a job in Nairobi. So he's decided to look for work abroad.
Because, in fact, I was planning to go to Dubai for at least 10 years. Then after 10 years, when I come back to Kenya, I'll be much better than now. I'll have my money to take me to, you know, to higher study, to do my higher studies in university level. Yeah.
The way you are as a person, please bring yourself to the standards that they want.
Yeah. Bernard has come to this recruitment office to interview for a job as a waiter at a five-star hotel in Dubai. Hundreds of young Kenyans have passed through this office looking for work in the Middle East. The successful ones have gone off to become physical trainers, lifeguards, or flight attendants. The owner, Lillian Zacco, says finding work is not just good for her clients, it's good for the country.
I want to help as many people, young people as possible in this country to go out, get a better working environment, get training. And now, since our country is developing so much, most of these young people are the ones who are coming back as managers or supervisors.
The number of jobs being created each year in Kenya has failed to keep pace with the fast-growing population. So many are drawn to wealthy cities in the Middle East, like Dubai, which are desperate for cheap labor to staff luxury hotels and homes. While some Kenyans have found success abroad, others say they were treated like slaves. Matilda Mwamba has just returned from Lebanon, where she spent several months working as a domestic servant. She found the job through a recruitment agency. She says she stood for hours at a sink, washing dishes and doing laundry for a large family, 7 days a week, with no time to rest or to go to church. Soon, she caught a chest infection and became too sick to work.
When I was sick, I told my boss that I wasn't feeling well and to please take me to the hospital. He refused. He bought me some Panadols, painkillers. He told me to take this Panadol and continue with the work, not to take medicine and rest.
With the help of the recruitment agency, she was able to come home. She says her life is better in Nairobi, even if she does not have much money. But she worries about her sister, still working in Saudi Arabia, and she tries to call her when she has enough phone credit. Today, she says, her sister must be too busy to answer. After hearing too many stories of abuse, the government last year banned Kenyans from traveling abroad to work as domestic servants, though they can still go for hotel work or other jobs. The foreign ministry estimates at least 100,000 Kenyans are working in the Middle East, and recruitment is showing no sign of slowing down. Gabe Josselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.